Ladies and gentlemen, I want to welcome you to the Psychology Forum of the Commonwealth Club. My name is Dr. Patrick O'Reilly, and we are absolutely delighted to welcome as tonight's speaker, Ms. Judith Horstman. She's the author of The Scientific American Day in the Life of Your Brain. I've read the book. It's absolutely delightful. It's just immensely entertaining and written for the lay reader, so you don't have to be a neuropsychiatrist to understand it. And they're actually selling it out in the lobby after the talk if you're interested. I highly recommend the book. You'll learn just exactly what your brain's doing as you go through your day, and you'll understand why you feel as you do, everything from feeling lonely to feeling pure joy. So please, Ms. Horstman is an award-winning journalist, a Fulbright scholar, and a journalism professor. So please welcome Ms. Judith Horstman. Thank you.
Thank you, Patrick. Wow. Thank you so much. That was a nice introduction, and thank you all for coming. I'm honored to be here. This is quite good company to be in. And I thought I'd start with a few disclaimers. First, I am not a neuroscientist. I am not any kind of scientist. I'm just a journalist. And this book is proof of what I tell my journalism students, which is that you don't have to know it. You just have to know where to find it. And the second disclaimer is that the idea, the really captivating idea for this book, is not mine either. It came from the good folks at Josie Bass, which is a venerable San Francisco publishing company. And they brought the idea to me, and I was so excited. I thought, wow, what a terrific idea. So I signed the contract, I cashed the advance check, and then I realized there were a few challenges. Whose brain? Man, woman, old, young? Black, white, Asian, whose brain? So I had to do a little research, and I found out that except for the extremes of aging and injury, most of our brains are pretty much the same. That doesn't mean we're the same, and our individual brains, of course, change. In a new book I'm working on now, and partly in this book, I talk about neuroplasticity, which is the amazing ability of our brain to change. But that being said, it's sort of like looking at cars. The combustion engine car, at least, all has the same basic mechanical equipment. But, of course, all the appurtenances and special things and colors and whatever are all different and individual, and that's kind of the way our brains are. The next challenge that I faced was, I'm writing an encyclopedia of brain activity. It really, if you talk about what you go on, you know, happens to you throughout the course of an ordinary day, then you're talking about basically everything your brain does. So that was a little daunting, but fortunately, the Scientific American articles that form the backbone of this book gave me some great information about that until I realized the other problem. We don't all do the same thing every day, do we? We don't wake up at the same time. We don't go to sleep at the same time. How is it going to pull that off? Well, I sort of shoehorned some things into hours where they seemed likely. And other things, for example, waking up at 5 a.m., which is where I start my book, was an easy decision because that's when my editor wakes up. So I knew he would like that. And 11 p.m. going to sleep is when I go to sleep, so that worked out. But other than that, there is some research that shows we tend to do things at certain times of the day, but we're still individuals. And now sex is pretty constant. I found that in cultures where we go to bed, where we live by artificial light, rather, most people tend to have sex around 10 p.m. So I was reassured to know that, and that's where I put it in the book. I found a lot of surprises when I was writing this book, and I really, really enjoyed it. It was a lot of fun to write this book, actually. Now, you've just heard me whine about the challenges, but it really was fun to write. And I'm glad to hear from Patrick that it's fun to read as well. My goal in writing it, since I specialize in writing about science for the general public, is to write something my 13-year-old granddaughter would understand and that a neuroscientist would enjoy reading. So I'm happy to hear that at least one psychologist enjoyed reading it very much. Some of the surprises that I found in researching this book. You all probably know that your brain makes new neurons, right? I kind of knew it, but not to the extent that it does. Your brain is producing new neurons in at least one part of your brain, the hippocampus, which is the part devoted to memory, short-term memory and learning. And that was somewhat a surprise to me. And the expression that you hear so often, I'm hardwired that way. I'm just made that way. Our brains are hardwired to do this and that. That's true for certain primitive functions. For example, the fear response from our amygdala, our primitive emotional brain that's always alert, a sentry, you know, looking out for danger. But really, our brain can rewire itself in many, many ways, and does. As you probably have heard about stroke victims, people who suffer strokes, the common theory, the common thinking in treatment was that only the treatment done in the first several months after the stroke was effective. So many times you see people stopping therapy after about 3 months. What they're finding now, however, is that in many cases, if you continue that therapy longer, that many abilities will return. Of course, it depends on where the stroke was and the severity of it. But that neuroplasticity is an amazing function of our brains. I discovered, for example, that if you perform a certain function and you're skilled at it, the part of your brain connected with that function is larger than that part of the brain in someone else's. Musicians are the example I found. A musician's brain, let's say a violinist, the parts of the brain connected with the muscles, the motor functions that go into playing the violin in the brain of a violinist are maybe up to 130 times larger than that same part of the brain in someone who's not a musician, and it's specific to the instrument that they play. Isn't that astounding? The other thing that I found out was a lot of interesting research on sleep. I know we have one person here who's interested in that. Anyone here wake up at 3 a.m.? Well, it seems that an historian and a scientist got together and did a little research and then compared their research, and they discovered that perhaps segmented sleep is more normal than 8 straight hours. Think about it. If you lived in a pre-industrial society, you would go to bed when the sun went down. You'd get up when the sun came up. And in the tropics, at least, that's 12 hours or more. So what people would do before the advent of electrical lighting, apparently, was sleep for 4 or 5 hours, wake up, clean the house, have sex, play musical instruments, talk about dreams. You know how in older books people are always comparing their dreams, which we don't do so much these days, then go back to sleep and wake up. And I found that immensely reassuring because I wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning fairly often, and I generally do a little something, not involving sex usually, but then I go back to sleep and wake up in the morning feeling pretty good. And another thing that I discovered, I love this. My belief in napping was validated by my research. I'm a great believer in napping. And when I was at USA Today in Washington, D.C., it was hard for me to get my usual afternoon nap. But I discovered there was an office that someone didn't use very often, and I would go in there and take my 15-minute afternoon nap, and it really helped me function more. And research now is showing a short nap in the afternoon helps us all function better. Of course, if you're piloting Northwest Flight 188, well, that would be a problem if both of them went to sleep. But in long-distance flights in Europe and other transatlantic and transpacific carriers, are you aware that they encourage pilots to nap? And I go to India, where my daughter has been living, fairly often, and that's, you know, 30 hours of travel. It's 2 12-hour flights from here. And I'm reassured to know that up in the cockpit, one of those guys has taken a nap from time to time while the other one's driving. So in the U.S., apparently, domestically, we don't allow pilots to nap in the cockpit. But did you see the news today about that, by the way? They weren't napping. What were they doing? They weren't arguing. No. Checking their schedules. What were they really doing? No, they were, she said it. What were they doing? They were on their laptops. They were on their laptops. I'll tell you, the addiction to our digital world is just amazing. And I talk about addiction in this book, and you know what I think the chapter is called, Addicted to Fill in the Blank. Because yes, you can become addicted to almost anything. When you do something pleasurable, it sets off a whole neurochemical cascade that sets up your brain to want more and more. And there's a whole long scientific thing about dopamine that I won't go into, but instead I will read you from my book. Would you like that? Oh, dear. Anyone else wear reading glasses? I was telling this gentleman that I have 5 pair, and I usually can't find more than one. Around 2 p.m., I put the chapter that I call Bored, 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 which is when you kind of have your afternoon let down, and you'll do anything to amuse yourself. So that's where I thought it would be appropriate to talk about Wired and Hooked, Addicted to Technology. You can't stop checking your email or your cell phone, texting messages while in a meeting, talking on the phone to someone else, or egads while driving. Or you may pop up a video game, Facebook or Twitter, to help control your fidgets. For a growing number of people, the hooked-up life they lead online may seem more important, more immediate, and more intense than the life they lead face-to-face. But in spite of the overwhelming impact of cell phones and the internet on daily life, just about anywhere anyone can get a signal, there's been little research on how intensive time online affects the brain. And in my follow-up book to this, Brave New Brain, which is about cutting-edge research on both fixing sick brains and enhancing a healthy brain and about things that may come in the future, this is repeated again even in the more current research. They know that this use of all these digital components are doing something to our brain, but they don't really know what. And one of the problems is trying to find a control group to study that isn't on the internet all the time. So, some studies have found a significant association between internet addiction and the symptoms of ADHD. We know what that is, right? They have also found that ADHD-like symptoms all but disappear when ADHD kids interact with the computer. The kids might actually be using web surfing and video games to help control their ADHD symptoms. Video games in particular offer escape and distraction. Players quickly learn that they feel better when playing, and so a kind of reinforcement loop develops. They self-medicate with electronics. And this is another interesting thing if you think about what drugs people take for ADHD. You know what they are, right? They're amphetamines, basically, aka speed, which seems counterintuitive. But like using the internet for ADHD addiction, it seems to help. Maintaining control over media habits is a challenge, like many other addictions. Internet and cell phone addiction seems more prevalent among those of us vulnerable to addiction in general. Indeed, internet addiction has been proposed, and not completely facetiously, as a new clinical disorder. There's a Center for Internet Addiction Recovery, which has a website. And not a trace of irony about the fact that it's using the medium of addiction to supposedly treat the addiction. So, and along with that, the TV, the addiction that many of us have to TV, have you ever wondered about that? Not so much even the addiction to turn it on, but why, when the TV is on, you can't stop looking at it? It seems that there is actually a process in our brain which is there to alert us to new and different stimuli. And the flickering TV constantly is sending messages that you need to pay attention to it. So it's setting off that little alarm in your brain. And any of you who might remember TV from the 1950s, probably no one in this room, right? Anyone remember it? I remember it, and it was fairly slow. And there were Hallmark Hall of Fame developed slow plays, and everything sort of stayed fairly static. What's happening with TV now? Yep, fast intercuts, fast edits, fast moving. And that's because whether they went to a neuroscientist or a psychologist or not, the editors of these programs have figured out how to keep your attention. And that's to keep the alert-seeking part of your brain on alert most of the time. And one of the people quoted in here is a guy who's actually a psychologist, who said he's appalled by the fact that if he gets a phone call when the TV is on, he can't keep from looking at the TV, that he himself is, though he even knows what's doing it, drives him. So you're very attentive. I thought we'd try and figure out what's happening now. 5:30. Oh, the dimming of the day. Depression. The day is dimming and so are you. As the day winds down, your spirits may be sinking, darkening with the light, especially in the early winter evenings. You may have the blahs or the blues or just feel down, low, bummed out. You are, you say, depressed. But then I go on to talk about what real clinical depression is. And that's a lot different from what most of us feel when we're just feeling sort of down. Do any of you feel that way also around this time of night when it's starting to get dark early? Is it just me? It's okay that I put it there? What I was actually thinking about when I put it there were the winter nights when I was a young mother, and I'd be trying to make dinner, and the kids would be screaming and yelling, and I was just so tired and just totally worn out at the time. So that's kind of why I chose that time. You can be addicted to grieving right here. Apparently, grief, again, sets up that same reward kind of pathway that we have. Well, let me read it to you. Can't get over losing a loved one. For most people, time eventually heals the wounds. But 10 to 20% of the bereaved can't accept or get over the loss. Even after years, a condition called complicated grief. Researchers are finding this could be partly because in those with complicated grief, reminders of the deceased activate the nucleus accumbens, a brain area associated with reward processing, pleasure, and addiction. A team led by Mary Frances O'Connor of the University of California, Los Angeles, studied functional magnetic resonance images of the brains of 23 women who had lost a mother or a sister to breast cancer in the past 5 years. As they were scanned, the women saw pictures and words reminding them of their lost loved one, which activated brain networks associated with social pain in all of the women. But in the 11 women with complicated grief, the images excited the nucleus accumbens as well, a part of the brain's reward circuit. So O'Connor believes this neural reward activity in response to memories of loved ones probably interferes with the ability of patients adapting to loss. Their brains still see these cues as predicting a rewarding experience, which activates the reward center. The scientists do not yet know why some people adapt better than others. But, yep, interesting. Well, the whole thing's interesting. It's your brain. Isn't that amazing? You've got the whole world between your ears. Everything. Does anyone have any questions for me? Because I could just keep on talking forever. You're sitting there so attentively.
Do we have a 10-minute break to check our email?
No, you'll be forced to do that while appearing that you're really involved in this, so you'll have to keep glancing up and down. Did you hear what he said?
No.
Can we have a 10-minute break to check our email? This gentleman has a question.
What's going on in your brain when you wake up in the morning, you look at the clock, maybe, and it's 4 o'clock, and you turn over, and you start thinking about things and solving problems and all, and somehow or another,
wow. He asked, did you hear the question? When he wakes up in the morning and the time goes by and you wonder what's happening. Well, I'm not a neuroscientist.
Right.
And that's one of the questions I probably can't answer. I can tell you that there is a state of sort of falling asleep or half wakefulness called hypnagogic state. And when you're in that state, that's when people have often what they call conscious dreaming. And so you could be in that half state at that time. And you're lucky to wake up and be able to lounge around in bed, hypnagogic. Some of the rest of us have to go to work. Yeah, so.
4:30 in the morning.
4:30 in the morning?
Right.
Well, you should be out there at work, yes. Yes.
Come in. It's a habit because he used to be, being a trial lawyer, he'd wake early and plan his argument. And that became a habit, and he does it.
Isn't that interesting? She's just said something very interesting. He is a trial lawyer. He used to get up at 4:30 in the morning to begin to plan his trial. He wouldn't get me to wake, and he'd use that time to think. And I have to say that I get up quite often. I'm usually up before 6, between 5 and 6. And I find that a really great time to check my email. But also a good time to think, because it's a quiet time. No one's going to call you unless they're in New York and they don't realize you're in California. But pretty much it's a quiet time when you can think about a lot of things. But when you said that became a habit, remember I talked about neuroplasticity, the ability of your brain to change and be changed. And it works both ways. You can form a habit that may be a good or a bad habit. But what they're discovering now, for example, about memories, we like to think that memories are sort of held in our individual neurons, kind of like love letters that are stored in a shoebox somewhere for us to retrieve. But actually, memories are form by the connections between neurons. It's the network that is really where your memories are. And so what you've set up there, which is partly involving memory, short-term memory at least, is that you've set up a whole network that's working on it. And we do that all the time. And a lot of time we do that and put ourselves on automatic pilot. How many drove or walked? You all got here somehow, right? Do you remember everything you passed on the way here? No, where our brain likes to be on autopilot because it's less metabolically expensive. So, more questions? Yes.
I actually have two questions.
Oh, dear.
First of all, I'm known for having a very bad memory, but I'm also known for having an uncanny ability to remember song lyrics from, 30 years ago.
Yes. Did you hear what she has to say? She's known for having a bad memory, I gather, for things that seem to be important, like maybe your mother's birthday. But she's known for having a really good memory for song lyrics, and some people have proposed that the working parts of her brain are taken up with, if I may use the word, trivia. But that's the first question. Okay, let's take the first question. Why do some people have a better memory than others? I don't know. I'm not sure anyone knows. Memory is all about the future. Basically, we have memory so that we can remember things that are good and things that are threatening. If we didn't have memory, if everything was new all the time, it would be a very difficult world to live in. So that's part of how we form memories, a lot based on fear and things that are important. So maybe you weren't scared enough for one time. As for song lyrics, I don't know. Isn't that amazing? There is somebody who's done some research on how a jingle or a tune or a song will get stuck in your mind, but I don't really know the answer to that. Her second question is, why are some people happier than others? And I think the word resilience might be better there. Why are some people better able to cope with the bad things in life? Life accidents happen to all of us, and some people are more resilient. They don't know the answer to that completely, but of course it goes back. You can talk about genetic influences. Obviously, the genes you inherit to some extent affect your predisposition to some of your emotions, right? And then the environment that you're raised in definitely impacts that. And now they're discovering something called epigenetics. Has anyone heard of epigenetics in this room? You have. Are you a neuroscientist?
No. I'm a layman.
Epigenetics, I only heard the term last year for the first time. And you can help me with the definition. I had it struggling writing it. Everyone has a genome, which is basically the DNA, the genes that make up who you are, and that's unchangeable. That's what you got. It's what you inherited. You're stuck with it. But there's also, outside of that double helix, there's some sticky kind of chemical stuff called the epi, which means on top of genome. And those are chemicals there looking for a way to get inside your DNA. Because while you're born with all the genes you will ever have, they're not all necessarily turned on. And the life experiences you have trigger chemicals in your body that can, if there are openings available, get in to the DNA and not change your DNA, but turn those genes on or off. And they've discovered, for example, in research with children who are bullied and abused when they're young, and you know the research on abused children, many abused children grow up to be very unhappy adults, but not all. So that doesn't explain it completely, or it may explain that at some crucial time in their life, there was a positive factor. Research with rats has shown that the rat mothers that are more affectionate, that lick and pay attention to their babies, tend to have baby rats that are less fearful and more adventurous, and that the rats who ignore their offspring or treat them badly tend to produce offspring that are fearful, not so well. So, you know, there's a lot of interesting stuff. And, of course, it's always the mother's fault, isn't it? You ever noticed that? Yes. Oh, funny you should mention that. There's a section in my book about that. Oh, she asked, is there a difference in the brains of people who are night owls and morning people? And actually, now that I think about the actual question, the way she answered, I have to say I don't know. But they're definitely different, and it's not something you can change easily. And there's a quiz in the book that the sleep researchers in England who devised it insisted I couldn't call a quiz, because they said it was an important research document. And it's one that basically asks a bunch of questions to determine if you're an owl or a lark. And I think it's very interesting, and I also think it's probably unnecessary. Anyone here who doesn't know if you're an owl or a lark? I think we pretty much know that, right? So I don't know if they know. I mean, probably someone does, but I don't know. I'm sorry. Yes?
Well, you have your neural pathways in your brain that cause your thoughts, and mostly repetitive. And if you're not getting what you want, your thoughts aren't your correct thoughts. How do you change your thoughts to get what you want in life? Someone said you got to say 2,000 affirmations. The more you can say
Well, there's another expression that I heard, and some of us tried to figure out where it came from. It's the 10,000-hour one. It takes 10,000 hours of practice to become an expert. And I tried to figure out where that came from. Somebody thought it might be Monty Python. What? Oh, yes. So he's an expert. I know, but quoting Malcolm Gladwell is like quoting Monty Python, except that he writes better. But he's not the expert. You have to go to what's the primary source, where did it come from? I don't know where it comes from, but we all do know the more we do something, the better we get at it, the more we remember it. And the thing about epigenetics that's so interesting is, haven't you wondered about people who talk about life transformation? They've been transformed by a religious experience, by a spiritual experience, by love, by some powerful emotion, and they've literally changed their lives and their minds. Epigenetics. I mean, your powerful emotions can affect your body chemistry, your brain chemistry. It can change things. It's just, you're a work in process. You know that? Honestly, from the moment you're born, you're a work in process. Every minute, if not every second, your brain is changing. This gentleman has his hand up.
About it, don't make any progress, but I go to sleep and I wake up in the morning, there it is.
He's talking about another, I mean, there's so much good stuff on sleep. Another wonderful thing about sleep and why I love napping, you stew and stew around with the problem, you go to sleep, you wake up, you have the solution. And that's, talk about that in the book, and that's absolutely been true to be true. And what I do often, I was a daily print journalist writing on deadline. And the last job I had was with Gannett News Service in USA Today, where I had a chance to really screw up in front of like 4 or 5 million daily readers. And you'd be writing on these very intense deadlines, and sometimes when I had like half an hour to do it, I would lie down for 5 minutes and close my eyes and just zone out, and I could do it better. And these things that we do instinctively, that this gentleman says he does instinctively, have been proven to be so, that if you take your focus away from something for a while, it will come more clearly when you bring it back. And you have something to say?
It seems to me that this is something to do with meditation. And I think that sleep clears, stops all the stuff going on. I mean,
well, actually, it doesn't.
It doesn't?
No. So she brings up meditation, one of my favorite subjects. And I have another confession to you, which is that I am a lapsed meditator. I did it very seriously for a while, and now I do it when needed, kind of like taking two Advil. But, you know, once I really was a serious meditator for probably a decade, and I think it does change your brain in ways. Richard Davidson at the University of Wisconsin has done a lot of research. He's one of many doing research. He's done research with Tibetan monks that the Dalai Lama provided for him, and their brains are physically changed. But these are people who have meditated in caves for decades. However, what Richie tells me, and I've seen it in other people, is that if you meditate 20 minutes to half an hour a day for 2 weeks, you will see a change in your brain. Now, meditating is different than sleep. One of the other things I found is your brain does not sleep. Your mind sleeps, but your brain is busy all night long. It's doing housework. It's solidifying some neural pathways. It's discarding other ones. You know, roads, country roads that don't get used, that aren't maintained, eventually the weeds grow up, cut off. It happens in your brain. And it's also getting rid of neural garbage, because there are byproducts of all the protein stuff going on in your brain that get cleared away whenever you're not conscious. They've also discovered, though, that in certain phases of sleep, your mind is as active as it is when you're awake. And I can't remember exactly what phases those are. I think it's the REM sleep, but I'm not certain. That's when we dream, right? So it's the REM sleep period. And meditation is not sleeping. Meditation is single point focus, and it's done. There are two major kinds. One is the single point focus, in which you think. Any meditators in this room? Okay, in which you bring your attention to a thought, a word like a mantra, a phrase, an image, or your own breath, and you keep your attention there, and you let everything run past in your mind, and keep that attention on this one thing. Very gently. You're not forcing it. The other kind is open meditation, which is called mindfulness meditation, in which you are not focusing on any one particular thing, but you're focusing on being very aware in the moment and very aware of everything that's happening to you. And neither of those involve sleep, because your mind is active. It's just not chattering at you. Our minds chatter at us all the time, right? It's called monkey mind. The meditators. Is that a fairly good definition for you meditators? That makes sense to you guys? Okay. It's a powerful tool. Yes?
So we have these habits, our neural habits. Then every day we're always eating things or drinking things that have their own chemicals that impact how we think or make us sleepy or agitated. Can you talk a little bit about that kind of overlay?
He's asking about diet and nutrition. Did everyone hear his question? He wants to know how that affects the brain. Obviously, your brain is part of your body. So everything that affects your body affects your brain and vice versa. So everything we take in has some effect. And obviously, there are foods that are better for us than other foods. And we all know, when we talk about ingestibles, we know the effect of alcohol on the brain and the body, and we know the effect of addictive drugs. But when you come to talking about food that we eat, it becomes a little more complex. But there are a number of things nutritionists have found that are better for us than other things. One thing I do talk about in here is something that I found. I have one of my younger daughter. Oh, she drives me crazy. I'm sorry. She's going to probably see this. She's very, very concerned about making sure that everyone eats. And if you get annoyed, she says, I think you should eat something, Mom. And it turns out she's right. It's always so annoying. Serotonin is the neurotransmitter and hormone that's responsible for keeping an even keel on our moods. And you probably know that the newer antidepressives are called selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors. Basically, they keep your brain from processing through the serotonin too quickly, so they keep the level up a little. And when we get hungry, and we don't have enough serotonin, but we also don't have enough tryptophan, which is needed to make serotonin. And to get tryptophan's an essential amino acid. We can't get it anywhere. We can't manufacture it. We have to get it from food. And some of the good sources of tryptophan happen to be things like protein, like, let's say, eggs, and complex carbohydrates like a whole wheat muffin, and, of course, milk, chocolate milk, perhaps. And it sounds like breakfast, doesn't it? Kind of why we need maybe a good breakfast. So my daughter's right. We need to eat on a regular basis. Of course, we need to eat the right things. And I don't know if that answers your question enough. It's a very complex question. Yes?
Do you get into something that's akin to what that fellow was talking about, napping and then getting a better vision of what's going on? Resolving the differences between our subconscious and our conscious?
No, I don't. The information we have now on consciousness is still pretty sparse. It used to be regarded as the realm only of philosophers, but now neuroscientists are tackling it as well. And there's a whole chapter in here on consciousness and what the latest theories are of what it is, but they're just that, they're theories. It is the biggest unsolved mystery of your brain is consciousness. So, yes. Synesthesia? Yes, but I didn't put it in this book. I'm sorry to say. Synesthesia is when you perceive something from one of your senses, but it comes out in the other one. Like you hear blue and you smell music. It's a confusion of the senses, and I did not talk about that. Does that mean you won't buy the book?
No.
Really? That's interesting. It could also be just a type of heightened awareness and great aesthetic.
No, but it's always repeatable.
Connecting food with words. Yeah. Okay. Yes. Yes, that's true. Food is not. So she connects taste. Maybe. Everything you feel, touch, hear, everything is neurological. I mean, your brain is, pain is perceived in the brain. It may be something that happens otherwise in your body. It's an alert. Actually, it's an alarm. It says there's something wrong, but all happens in your brain. Sex happens in your brain. Yes.
Einstein's brain, it's been
analyzed.
Have you commented on that?
Nope, I do not. Einstein's brain. It's still in its jar. Yes?
During hypnosis, you lose power of your brain?
No. Hypnosis is an altered state of consciousness. And you cannot be hypnotized against your will. It's agreeing with someone to enter into an altered state in which you may have more access to certain parts of your mind. And there's a chapter about that in here. Yes?
I seem much more intelligent when I'm dreaming.
Did everyone hear that? She seems much more intelligent when she's dreaming. Is there any truth? Is she more intelligent? Only you can tell us that. But it's nice. That's what a lovely way to dream. I usually feel stupid in my dreams. That's what, you must be an optimist. Are you an optimist?
I think I'm just kind of regular, but my dreams, I have no boundaries or limitations that I have in real thinking.
There's a psychologist here you should speak to right after the session. He's sitting over there. That sounds good to me. Yes?
One comment on the connection between
synesthesia.
Yeah, it may be more related to olfactory memories. You know, olfactory memories are very powerful. Perhaps actually,
it's in here.
Yeah.
It's extremely powerful, and for some reason it's connected to memory. I don't know why. By the way, the olfactory bulb is one of only two parts in the brain where we know for a fact that humans create new neurons. So in our sense of smell, our olfactory section and the other, I talk about coming to consciousness talks about, no, that's the other one. Waking to the world talks about how your senses, coming to our senses, how they do it. Oh, dear, I can't remember how many words Proust wrote based on his exquisite memory of the taste of a madeleine, which is a specific kind of little French cookie. And so I was going to look up the number of words, but I guess if I wrote it, I don't have to look it up, right? Did everyone hear her question? It's actually a very interesting one. She talks about people who have been diagnosed with a disease. In this case, she mentioned a tumor specifically, which is something you can see on image. You can biopsy. You know it's there. And they do some sort of, you're not talking about alternative drugs or things. She's talking about mental processes, and it disappears. And there have been cases recorded of that, and I don't know that it's being studied that much, but it should be. I think the power of the brain is amazing. It's really, really amazing. As I said, the plasticity of the brain, that certain parts of your brain will get larger and have more circuits developed in connection with things that you do and practice. Why shouldn't that be true of parts of your body as well? Certainly muscles react the more you do things, but no, I don't have anything on that. I'm sorry. Yes?
Mm-hmm. Very susceptible.
Mm-hmm.
And some marketing has gotten so sophisticated that there's this intentional manipulation at a very neurological level, if you will, of what we want, what we think we want, what we like, what we don't like. I'm curious if you go to that in the book at all, or if you even came across in your research any discussion that, well, maybe in some future that type of manipulation might actually be not just frowned upon, but actually becomes our vote.
He's talking about the way they try to make us sell things by manipulating. What are you proposing they manipulate?
Oh, our, you know, if it's subconscious or conscious, I don't know, but it's, you know, I have to eat this or I have to eat that or I hate that person.
About stimulating our desire to buy certain things. He's talking about marketing techniques. I don't think that'll ever become forbidden, but certainly it's common knowledge. I don't really write about that in here. I was talking about how the brain is primed to respond to unusual or novel stimuli or threats. But certainly that's done all the time. People are trying to persuade us to buy things. They're using manipulative things. And they keep our attention, those great video music video things. it's no surprise that many of the directors making full-length films now came from the music video genre, because that's where they learned those, you know, those cuts and quick things, and that's why so many of them are used in movies. I mean, you go to a film and a lot isn't happening the first 10 minutes. You think about leaving, but it's because we're so geared to being stimulated all the time. It's very interesting. But I doubt that it'll be forbidden.
We have time for one more question.
Oh. Have we got one more? Yes. Anything in my book about exercise and the effect on your brain? I really wanted to mention that right off. Thank you so much for bringing it up. Absolutely. Exercise is the best thing you can do for your brain and your body. Exercise, physical exercise, encourages the growth of new neurons. They arise in response to that. It also pumps more oxygenated blood through your brain, keeping it healthier, and it keeps your body healthy. And it's one of the best things that you can do for your brain or your body. And we should all be doing it, right? Tomorrow. No, I'm a great believer in it. I think that both exercise and meditation, which is a kind of mental exercise, are really wonderful for us. And this book and my book that's coming up talk about that. Thank you.
Thank you.
You've been great. Thank you very much.